RSV Academy. Talking about RSV with Barney S. Graham. Decoding RSV and beyond.
Hello and welcome to the RSV Academy podcast, your pathway to the forefront of the latest discoveries, innovations, and insights related to respiratory syncytial virus. I am your host, Federico Martinón Torres from the University of Santiago, and today we are truly honored to be in the company of a scientific luminary, Dr. Barney Graham. Dr. Graham is not just a researcher, he's a pioneer, and his extensive work and publications have significantly advanced our understanding of RSV. So welcome, Barney, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Federico, and I look forward to our conversation.
As the Deputy Director of the Vaccine Research Center and the Chief of the Viral Pathogenesis Laboratory at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease in the States, his contributions in the field of RSV research have been nothing short of revolutionary. With a career spanning decades, Dr. Graham has consistently been at the cutting edge, pushing boundaries and setting new paradigms in our understanding of RSV, among other pathogens. His achievements in structural vaccinology have been key not only for RSV, but also instrumental to the rapid success of COVID-19 vaccines and other pathogens. Today, we'll be discussing his most recent findings, exploring the nuances of his research, and gaining a glimpse into the future trajectory of RSV research. So, I would like to start with a very obvious and first question, and it is, what is RSV for you? What comes to your mind first when you think of RSV? And don't tell me it's the profusional configuration of the F antigen, which might be on the other hand.
Well, RSV is how I started in biomedical research. It's how I started as a scientist. When I saw one of the first AIDS patients in Tennessee back as a chief resident in 1982, when you see HIV during your training, it has a big impact on you. What you see in your training changes your life. And it made me want to become a viral immunologist. And when I went to ask how to be a virologist, Peter Wright gave me a vial of RSV and said, see if you can grow this. And so this is how I started in research. And so RSV has been something I've worked on since 1985. It's something that I started and really focused for the first 20 years on safety. My whole work was based on understanding how the vaccine-enhanced disease occurred back in the 1960s. And then after I went from Vanderbilt to NIH, I had a chance to apply other technologies to the problem of RSV. And as you indicated, we were able to solve some structures eventually with Jason McClellan, who was a fellow in Peter Kwong's laboratory at the time in structural biology. And Jason and I collaborated to solve several structures, including the prefusion F structure. And now we have some vaccine candidates and even some antibodies. And now I left NIH about a year and a half ago. I retired from federal service, and now I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a faculty member at the Morehouse School of Medicine. And now I'm working to see if we can make sure the vaccines and things we make can be equitably distributed around the world.
Thank you. Although I know the answer, I'm sure our listeners would like to directly hear from you how the solution of the profusional structure has contributed to the development and the success in the development of an effective RSV vaccine.
Yeah, well, it really started from that early work on how to keep vaccines safe. And what we learned, the field, my lab and other people in the field learned over many years that there were two problems. There was an antibody problem and a T-cell problem. And people have been working on the T-cell problem, trying to make sure you have the appropriate pattern of CD4 T-cell responses and appropriate amounts of interferon gamma and avoiding IL-4 and IL-13 that we think complicate the pathogenesis of RSV. But the antibody problem was one in which a lot of antibody was made, but it wasn't very effective at neutralization. And many people had thought about this over the years. Jason and I worked extensively with Jose Malero, who was a faculty member in Madrid and had worked on RSV for many years and HMPV. And together, we talked a lot about protein structure and protein function, and not just the F protein, but also the G protein. And Jose did some early experiments suggesting that most of the effective antibody was directed toward not the protein we were using. And Bob Lamb's studies in the mid-2000s were able to show that in paramyxoviruses, PIV5 initially, that they were able to solve a structure for a pre-fusion F molecule that was distinct from the post-fusion F form of this fusion protein that undergoes a massive rearrangement. And so during that the late 2000s, because of the thinking we had done about RSV, and because of this initial idea from the Lamb group and Jose Malero's ideas, we wanted to solve the structure of the prefusion F molecule, mostly to see how it worked and to see what it looked like, and to understand it in a more basic way. And so Jason and I started working on this at the end of 2008. And we started working on different epitopes. The ones we knew at the time were what we call antigenic site 2 and 4. These were, site 2 is the target for palivizumab that most people are familiar with, that is used for prophylaxis of infants. And it's been approved since 1998. Site 4 is a site that Jose was famous for. He made an antibody called 101F that was site 4 specific. And so using some of the antibodies we had, we were able to solve just peptide structures of those epitopes. But we knew there was more, and we eventually got the post-fusion F structure, and finally, you probably don't have time to go through all the minor details, but finally we were able to capture the structure of the prefusion F protein. And the basic strategy was that we were looking for antibodies that could neutralize virus but did not bind the postfusion F. And we found those in a couple of different ways. One is we had a collaboration with the group in Xiamen, China that we started in 2010 to find and screen antibodies that could have those properties. And we found one called 5C4 after 13,000 clones were screened. And so we had that one. And then Jason found a few in the patent database that had been derived by AIM Therapeutics that had those properties, but they didn't really know what they had. And so we used three antibodies that we had found, two from the patent database and one that we had made ourselves, and were able to then capture, use that to hold the prefusion F molecule together, which is a very unstable conformation. So the antibody, the FAB on top and a trimerization domain on the bottom at the C-terminus called foldon, those together allowed us to capture enough of the prefusion form that Jason could make a crystal and solve the crystal structure of F in its prefusion form. And once we had that, then a lot of the protein engineering became a lot more obvious. Once you have the structures and at the atomic level, you can see the amino acid side chains, you can make modifications in the protein and hold it together without the antibody on top. And so that's the story in a nutshell. And once we had that protein, it was so immunogenic and changed everything in terms of the neutralizing activity that could be induced that now, instead of just a basic research problem project, it became a real vaccine development project.
Indeed, it's awesome to hear that that story directly from you. And indeed, actually, all the license or about to be licensed solutions for RSV are based precisely on this finding, no? And all the having common the use of the of this structure, no? The perfusional configuration of the F protein. But you have also worked in other potential antigens for RSV. I mean, do you think with just the F antigen we have this solved, or we can further improve the antigen configuration of vaccines or other prophylactic measures against RSV, or it's no need to further dig in and with this basis, everything with this pilar, everything is solved for RSV?
Well, we think this solves the antibody problem that we had with the vaccine-enhanced disease, because now the ratio of binding antibody to neutralizing activity is very low, meaning most antibody is neutralizing the virus. And so you don't have a lot of extra antibody that can result in immune complex formation and complement activation and destruction of the tissue in the small airways. So we think that this solves the antibody problem. You could potentially add things like the central conserved domain of G. There are a couple of good neutralizing epitopes in the middle of the G glycoprotein that could be added. You might want to add some additional T cell epitopes. We did a lot of that during the mid-2000s. That's really how it started in a way, is that, you know, if you delivered F as a gene-based delivery and keep it anchored in the membrane, it's a little more stable than when you just have a secreted protein. If you secrete the protein, it immediately rearranges. So all the five phase three trials that were done in the past with either protein isolated from virus or protein made with in insect cells or in CHO cells, all of that protein had flipped into the post-fusion. If you deliver it membrane anchored from a vector or a nucleic acid, then it is stable for a few minutes. And the way we immunized mice in with the Chinese group in Xiamen Medical University was to deliver it in an adenovirus vector, membrane anchored. And immunizing mice with that construct allowed those mice to make at least some B cell clones that recognize site zero, which is the top of the molecule that unravels. So getting to the gene-based delivery, making F available for proteolysis and making CD8 T cell responses, and then keeping those epitopes in the right shape, all of that started improving the vaccine. But getting that structure stabilized, I think, is what really changed everything. But if you added some T cell epitopes, if you delivered as a gene-based vector, things like that, if you added the central conserved domain of G, it's possible that you could make it a little better. But I think we'll have to see if we need it to be better. It may be good enough already. The other thing we still need to do is find ways of delivering and creating better mucosal immunity. We also still need to find solutions for the antigen-naive child between 6 months and 5 years of age, because we still don't have a solution for them yet. There's a lot of things coming out for RSV this year, mm-hmm. for the elderly, for maternal immunization, for antibody prophylaxis of young children, young infants. But we still don't have something for the 6 month to 5 year old child that we probably still need.
Yeah, and you have already pointed out that the mucosal approach might be the difference, no? Because one of the challenges is indeed what you have just said, in the sense that we have already solutions for the elderly, for the very young infants, but maybe this relates also to the difference of the infection itself in the infant versus the adult patient, no? And part of the trick may be there. What are your guesses in that regard? I mean, what can explain the different behavior of the infection in the infant as compared to the elderly, beyond the inflammation and the obvious different circumstances? But also, I think they are important to explain how the behavior of the vaccines based on the PrEF may be completely different in terms of development so far in the elderly population as compared to the infant population.
All right. Excuse me. Right now, what we're doing with the elderly and maternal vaccines is boosting. Everyone who's an adult, anyone over 2 years of age, has already been infected with RSV multiple times, and so the vaccination of boosting is very different than the vaccination of priming. And so what we've done so far is boost. And so we're boosting some of the better B cell clones to make good high quality antibody available. And most of it is parenteral. So the antibody's really only diffusing from serum into the lung and lower airway to protect against disease and lower airway disease. We're not really making a lot of antibody that gets into the upper airway, so we're probably not going to stop infection. In children, when you're giving vaccine for the very first time and priming, you have to get the T cell response pattern correct, or you may run into trouble later. You don't have to really worry about that with boosting, because the T cell response pattern has already been established. And so getting the T cell response pattern right in children means that you may need a different delivery approach. And as you said, reducing the amount of upper airway infection, that may be important for children, because children with upper airway disease also have trouble breastfeeding and things like that. And so the approach for young children vaccination may be slightly different, and it's just going to take a little bit longer. There are people working on things that include live attenuated viruses or chimeric viruses or gene-based vector approaches, things like that, or it's possible proteins with a different adjuvant or delivery system might also end up being effective, but this is going to take more time.
Yeah, I think you already in some manner anticipated the answer to my next question, and is what can we expect in terms of transmission and instead of reduction of or herd protection of the current available vaccines and monoclonal antibodies? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about having any other impact beyond the direct protection of those vaccinated or immunized with the monoclonal antibodies?
Well, I tend to be very optimistic, but I'll give you an optimistic and a realistic opinion, because as we've seen from COVID, it's very, and as we already know from influenza and RSV, even with immunity, it's very hard to stop respiratory infection. Respiratory virus infections tend to recur even in the presence of good immunity. And the system, in one sense, is designed to protect the lower airway, but not necessarily fully protect the upper airway. I don't know if that's adaptive, because it helps you fill in gaps of your immunity, it helps you keep up with new strain variations or what, but that's just the way respiratory viruses work. So that's the realistic answer. My optimistic answer is that, RSV doesn't have a reservoir. It doesn't have an animal reservoir. And so, you know, the big dream would be, what if we start dampening down or improving immunity? The vaccine immunity is better than natural immunity. It's way higher. It's supernormal levels of neutralizing activity. And so if we had that, we start get a childhood vaccine, maybe RSV would disappear. Mm-hmm. That would be the big dream. Now, the intermediate dream would be, I think RSV is the basis for a lot of other respiratory disease. And if you could really control RSV, especially in the young infant, you might create overall improved lung health. And you'd have less COPD, you'd have less asthma, you'd have less wheezing, you'd have less other infections. You know, sometimes RSV often precedes influenza. Maybe influenza would not be as severe if we could get rid of RSV. A lot of the pneumococcal and other bacterial infections may not be as severe if we could get rid of RSV. So, you know, a lot of times you don't learn these things until you have a vaccine. When RSV starts getting better controlled, then you get to see what happens. And that's what will be fun over the next 5 or 10 years is, you know, what happens when you start controlling RSV.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that now that we are going to start to obtain real life data of the implementation of these vaccines and monoclonal antibodies will be essential to check, no, if these expanded benefits that you are already foreseeing, no, and mentioning actually occur or not by preventing RSV the way we are doing it. Because on the other hand, for me, one of the questions that comes when I think of the eventual impact of vaccines and monoclonal antibodies on this lung function, co-infections, future lung trajectory, etc. What struggles me is that both the monoclonal antibodies and the available vaccines won't avoid infection, but they will impact the development of severe disease, but they won't avoid infection. So I'm not so sure if we really have the knowledge on the pathogenesis of these complications, of this additional burden. You know what I mean? So I don't know what you think in this regard, because if we are not actually avoiding infection and it's more a host trigger interaction by the infection itself and not by the severity of the infection, maybe we won't be seeing this expanded impact. What do you think?
I think we won't know until we stop infection. Once you start stopping infection, then you'll start learning, you know, what are the consequences. And even in some of the prior vaccine trials that didn't meet their endpoints and development stopped, even with the original Novavax product that had a small benefit, it had partial efficacy for a few months mm-hmm. in babies in South Africa in particular. But the effect on overall lung health and overall outcomes at a year was even better. And so I'm hopeful and optimistic that if we can really, if we can have 85% efficacy over 6 months instead of 39% efficacy over 2 or 3 months, then the effect on overall lung health could be even more dramatic. That's what I'm really hoping to see. Yeah.
And for the other big hope you have or big wish you mentioned, no, about the possibility to really, considering, no, that we don't have any other reservoir than human for RSV, if we are able to really tackle with the reservoir and eradicate the RSV. The tricky question is, which is or who are the reservoirs of RSV? Where are the RSV hides in between seasons?
We don't really understand that, but we know that RSV, for instance, can be shed from people with HIV infection. Children with HIV infection can shed RSV for a year, over 200 mm-hmm. days. And sometimes people with COPD can harbor RSV, you know, in I don't know where it's harbored, but it's there, and it may just be that there's enough low-level circulation of RSV even in off-season that it somehow gets through. But my assumption is that you won't be able to stop transmission, and so eradicating a respiratory virus disease may just not really be feasible. But on the other hand, rinderpest, you know, it's a respiratory disease in cattle. It was eradicated, and with a vaccine. And so, I don't know if rinderpest can be eradicated. Why not hope that RSV could be eradicated?
Okay, you really are optimistic, and I really hope you are right indeed in that. I have another question. You already mentioned, you know, that you started to work on the subject, focusing on safety, you know, and the problem of enhanced disease that appear in the with the inactivated vaccine in the 60s, you know, and all the problems that arise from there. And I'd like you to tell me why. I mean, this was one of the threats that we had with SARS-CoV-2 also, no? At the beginning, the possibility of enhanced disease with the new vaccines that we didn't know for sure how they were going to work in this regard. And, well, in real life, we showed that there was genetic imprinting, but there was not actually any change in terms of clinical disease. And it looks like that what we saw even with SARS-CoV-1, it did not happen with SARS-CoV-2, no? What's the difference there? Why did not happen here? Is because of the better selection of the antigen? Is because of differences in the virus itself?
Well, most of the enhanced disease findings for SARS-1 were all in animal models. And so we don't really know for sure whether that would have happened in people. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful, but you know, the RSV findings were the basic guidelines, the guardrails for keeping something safe is basically to say you have to have high quality antibody and you have to try to avoid Th2 CD4 T cell responses. Those are the basic parameters around which RSV vaccine safety is built right now. Those same ideas were used for SARS-CoV-2, and I spoke to the FDA several times, and I actually wrote a short commentary that was published on how can we go fast and keep it safe early on in the SARS-CoV-2, because we needed to go fast. And so those basic ideas of making sure you have high quality antigen, high quality antibody, and keep it, avoid Th2 type responses were basically the concepts that the FDA used to rapidly review and approve things. So RSV actually impacted SARS-CoV-2 in that interesting way. I hope that remains true because, you know, in measles, we also had a vaccine-enhanced disease, but it didn't show up until 4 years or 5 years later. And that was because measles was relatively easy to neutralize, and even bad antibody neutralized it for a while. And until that antibody waned over several years, and then the T cell response pattern problem created this atypical pneumonia with measles, you didn't really see it. So I'm hoping that we don't see anything like that with SARS. I think SARS has evolved in a way that has made it, SARS-CoV-2 has evolved to be more of an upper airway infection. It still causes disease. It can still infect the lower airway, but it's in some ways cold adapted to grow better in the nose, and it's become less virulent overall. So I'm hoping that we don't see anything like that with SARS-CoV-2 infections, you know, several years out from now.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, of course, although the focus of this podcast is RSV, I really need to, I mean, having you here, I also have the chance to ask you a little bit beyond RSV itself, no? And I think, well, we all know that all your work on the structure-based vaccine antigen design that was also instrumental for SARS-CoV-2 can be applied, and you actually have been working with that approach in other diseases. So what can you tell us about that, and which other microorganisms are you trying to tackle with this approach?
Well, You know, what we did with RSV and then with SARS-CoV-2 was really in some ways the same, because it was all based on stabilizing the pre-fusion form of a class 1 fusion protein. So the spike and the RSVF are both class 1 fusion proteins, and other envelope viruses that have class 1 fusion proteins like HIV or influenza, Ebola, Lassa, paramyxoviruses, they can also sometimes be improved by protein engineering of that fusion protein. Now, some of those viruses, like, for instance, influenza, their HA is relatively stable to begin with. It doesn't really change that much until it gets into a low pH situation. So it's not as inherently unstable as RSV was. So in some cases, it won't make as much difference. But for RSV to a large extent, and for some of the paramyxoviruses, and to some extent for coronaviruses, stabilization of this class 1 fusion protein will make a big difference. And so how that's applied to other viruses, like the alpha viruses, flaviviruses, bunnyviruses with class 2 fusion proteins, I think is still an ongoing project. We still have a lot to learn about the non-envelope viruses and class 3s. I think we're close to having something for some of the class 3 fusion fusion protein viruses like CMV. I'm hoping that the GB is pre-fusion complex is close to being stabilized. We'll see. But the whole idea of just knowing the atomic level structure of your antigen and knowing exactly where antibodies bind and knowing that kind of level of detail, that really has changed everything in the way you think about putting together a vaccine. It's almost hard to conceive of designing a vaccine now unless you know the atomic level structure of your antigen, because otherwise you really don't know what you're doing. And when you can see it, it becomes much simpler.
And I mean, I think that it's awesome to speak with you and to have all your insights in this regard. You have been also published several works and editorials on how to anticipate the next threats, no? And you mentioned the concept of prototype pathogens, no? To work with the potential threats to be ready, no, and not to start from scratch. Can you elaborate a little bit on this and on this idea and this concept?
Well, this really also comes from the RSV work and then the coronavirus work. And one of the reasons we could go quickly with coronavirus is because between 2014 and learning the structure of the spike protein around 2016, from that point, we found that the same proline substitutions at the top of the central helix could stabilize about a dozen different coronavirus spike proteins. And so that's why we were able to make those proline substitutions at 986, 987 and say, we're going to go with this without any additional experimentation. We could have spent 3 to 4 months testing different things, but we would have ended up with the same thing we selected because of what we knew from before. And so understanding virus families in that way, I think, gives us a better chance and a better platform if we know how to do the next thing, how to design the antigen, how to deliver the antigen to be effective ahead of time. It gives us a big jump on the next pandemic. And we were very fortunate with coronavirus because we already knew in 2019 that design and delivery by either protein or by mRNA could effectively prevent lethal challenge from a coronavirus. We were using MERS coronavirus at the time, but we know the same thing about paramyxoviruses. We were using Nipah as a prototype for paramyxoviruses. So I think trying to understand how to make generalizable vaccine solutions and delivery options ahead of time can only help us either be prepared for or rapidly respond to the next problem.
Well, thank you very much. We are reaching the end of this conversation because I would extend this forever, and I'm really enjoying this conversation, and as I hope our listeners are also doing. And I only have a final comment, and of course, feel free to bring any other topic or comment you wish and may I have omitted. But it is going back to RSV. We are really, in a different situation now, and we are in the right place to really tackle with the disease. No, but what are your expectations for the real life implementation of these vaccines? No, we already have monoclonal antibodies, vaccines for the elderly, vaccines for the pregnant woman, but we know that this is going to start by the rich countries, like usual, and not precisely for the countries where the burden is the highest. No, so what are your expectations in this regard and your wishes, maybe?
Well, as I go into the final phase of my career, I chose Morehouse School of Medicine because of their interest in equity. And equity is part of their mission statement. And there's only 4 million babies born a year in the U.S., but there's 120 million babies born in the world. And so, it's important to take care of those 4 million babies. But what about the other 116 million babies? And we have to find ways of exporting not just the product, but the technology and the capability and the ability to make and take care of your own regional problems, in part because not only for the problems that exist, but for future problems. And we have to facilitate ways for low and middle income countries to be able to make their own solutions for their own regional problems before they become global threats. It's in everyone's best interest for that to happen. So I want to work on that problem. And for RSV, we have still a long way to go. And since some of this was done in the government setting, all these licenses, all the IP is non-exclusive. So that helps a little bit with cost, but it doesn't transfer the know-how for how to make these things in different settings. So we have a long way to go for making things equitable, for making sure the right people get trained, make sure the right people are making the decisions so that some of these better approaches can be implemented and be implemented for all people. I mean, what good does it do to solve a respiratory problem for 5% of the world? It doesn't stop the respiratory virus very well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and finally, I want to ask you for a tip for all the researchers and students that are tuning in, and also for myself. What advice would you give to those aspiring to make a mark in the field of virology and immunology, as you have already done?
Well, I'm so excited for the young people, including you, Federico. I mean, think of the technology we have now. It's so amazing. It just amazes me every day what we can see and what we can do and what we can measure, even at the single cell level. So I can't imagine. I think all these problems are solvable with the technology we have right now. It's really just a matter of finding talented young people who are interested in implementing some of these things. So part of the advice for vaccines is you have to start earlier in your career because it might take you 30 years to make a vaccine. So you have to start a little bit early. It doesn't always happen in 1 year. But the technologies we have now to both see and understand and measure things is amazing. And I think we have what we need to solve a lot of the problems that we have in terms of infectious diseases in the world, and we just need young people to apply themselves using these tools. And I think in 30 years from now, we would have a lot of answers.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Barney. Thank you for sharing your invaluable insight with us. Your work continues to pave the way for the advancements not only in RSV research, but in other infectious disease threats. And we are really honored to have had this discussion with you today. That is really inspiring, for sure, for me, and I'm sure that also for the listeners. Thank you very much, Barney.
Thank you, Federico. It's my pleasure to be here.
On behalf of the RSV Academy team, just to thank you for listening, and please stay tuned for more discussions on the rapidly evolving and captivating world of RSV. Thank you very much.